The next speaker, if anybody was here, I hope some of you were yesterday morning. You heard Richard Heinberg, brilliant presentation on energy and debt. He really outlined so much of the problem so clearly and articulately. And he's back to talk about some of the solutions. In case you weren't here, let me just briefly introduce Richard. He's a senior fellow at the Post-Carbon Institute. He's written 11 books. 11 books. Wow. Darn. All right, 11 books. The most recent are The End of Growth, I think that's 2011, and Snake Oil, which is his most recent book. Richard has been a lecturer all over the world, I think 14 different countries. You've probably seen in many films and many documentaries. He is one of the leading experts, I think, in what I call the end of the age of extraction. He is also a wonderful violinist. I hope many of you heard that. And as a former pianist, I can assure you the most brilliant people that live in are all former musicians. People, Richard Heinberg.
Steady-state economics, which is a very important subject, written about brilliantly by one of my heroes and mentors, Herman Daly. But in fact, I'm not going to talk exactly about that. I'm going to talk about the economics of degrowth. Why so? Well, if we were to imagine just leveling off with the rate of economic activity we see in the world today, we won't grow anymore, we'll just continue the size of the economy we have now. That effectively would be the... it wouldn't work. The reason I say that is the Global Footprint Network, which does enormous amount of work and very good work in accounting for how much we're actually using the Earth's resources, especially renewable resources. It says we're using 1.5 Earths currently. How can you even do that? Well, by drawing down on the future biological productivity of the planet. So obviously we can't continue doing that. We actually have to shrink the size of the total human economy and continue doing that for a while until we're within the long-term budget of Earth's renewable biological capacity. And at the same time, we have to stop extracting non-renewable resources, including not just fossil fuels, but minerals and metals, and get to a 100% recycling economy. It's very, very different. Yeah, very, very different kind of economy than what we have now, and it's a smaller economy, inevitably. Now, as I tried to explain yesterday morning, or was it last week? I forget. It feels like so long ago now. This is inevitable anyway. Our economy will shrink, whether it's by plan and design and management or by collapse. So I suppose you could say my talk is the economics of collapse, but not necessarily. I mean, theoretically, I think it's possible for us as intelligent, cooperative human beings to maintain the functionality of society while shrinking it, using planning, using policy. Again, this is not necessarily the most likely outcome. My friend John Michael Greer would probably say the overwhelmingly likely outcome, given the history of civilizations and how all civilizations tend to go through this cycle of growth and collapse. The overwhelmingly likely outcome is going to be a chaotic collapse, or not just tomorrow, but over the course of the next couple of centuries or so. Maybe so, but let's do a thought exercise together, a thought experiment. What would it take to shrink the global economy in a controlled way? It's not going to be easy. Granted, growth has become a systemic necessity of the global economy. It's necessary for government. Governments need continually increasing tax revenues so that they can fund increasing government services. We depend upon continual economic growth to create more jobs for more people. After all, the population is still growing, so we need more jobs for more people. How do you do that? Grow the economy. The financial world expects returns on investments. How are those returns going to come? Only by the growing economy. So corporations want economic growth. Labor wants economic growth. Government wants economic growth. The constituency for economic degrowth is very, very small. But remember, this is not optional. It's going to happen one way or another. So bear with me. And my thought experiment is going to take the form of a 10-point plan for shrinking the economy controllably. Number one, energy. As I mentioned yesterday, energy is the heart of everything. It's really what runs the economy. We say that we tend to imagine that the economy runs on energy, on money, but money is just a marker for energy in the final analysis. So we need to protect the ecosystem as the economy contracts. And the obvious way to do that is to cap carbon, keep the oil in the ground, as we've heard, and reduce carbon emissions according to an annual percentage. I would actually go further than that, and I would say cap energy. If the economy is going to contract, that almost inevitably means that energy will contract. And what do we do with energy anyway? All of that's what runs the economy. All of the extractive and transformative processes that are overtaxing nature systems, all of those are expressions of energy production and consumption. So let's plan to reduce our energy budget. That's number one. Number two is make it renewable. Where we are using energy, producing and using energy, let's make it renewable energy. But that comes with a caveat, which is that as we do that, we're going to have to change how we use energy. You know, we're not going to be able to realistically unplug the power plant, the coal power plant, and plug in a solar panel and keep using energy the way we customarily do it now. It's not going to work that way. We built our entire massive infrastructure of society around the unique qualities and characteristics of fossil fuels. That massive infrastructure is not going to work the same way with energy sources that have fundamentally different qualities and characteristics. Just one example is transportation. We built transportation around liquid fuels, oil. Oil has it's energy dense, it's highly portable, and we're not going to be able to rebuild our transport system as it is now around renewable electricity. Parts of it, maybe yes, in a transitional fashion, yes, you can have an electric car, it's possible to do that, but you can't have an electric airliner. It ain't going to work. Batteries would be way too heavy for the thing to ever take off. So there goes air transport, airlines, most of tourism, etc., etc. That's a fairly big deal. That's just one example. Agriculture, as industrial agriculture as we have it now, has been built around fossil fuels. So take away the fossil fuels, we have to redesign agriculture around ecological, perennial agriculture. Appropriate technology. rather than the kinds of technologies that we have today, again, have been built around fossil fuels. So we have to rethink technology almost from the ground up. So that's number two. Three is money. Right now we have a debt-based currency that assumes the continual ability to pay interest on existing debt. And it also assumes that debt will continually be increasing to create more currency to supply economic growth. This type of currency is not well suited to a contracting economy. So we need fundamentally different kinds of currencies. And I say currencies rather than a currency, because what we need really is an ecosystem of different kinds of currencies performing different functions and in different locales. And I'm not an advocate of using precious metals as currency. We tried that, and that didn't work particularly well. We had extreme economic inequality and booms and busts and all of that with gold-based and silver-based currency. So that's not the answer. We can do a lot better than that. And while we're talking about debt-based currency, debt is in a huge overhang right now. It's impossible that we'll ever be able to pay back even a substantial portion of existing debt in a contracting economy. So we have to just cancel debt. It's going to happen anyway through massive default. So let's get ahead of the curve and just do it. That's number three. Number four, equity. In a contracting economy, economic inequality is unsustainable in the truest and deepest sense of the word. We've only been able to sustain the economic inequality we have today in terms of the public putting up with it because the pie has been growing all the time. So there's the perception, well, you know, even though those folks up there on the hill are so much richer, we can catch up with them sooner or later as long as the economy keeps growing. But as the pie shrinks, those with the smallest portions soon find themselves unable to even maintain life itself. So inequity becomes a ticking time bomb from a social standpoint. Two ways of dealing with that. One, at the top of the economic pyramid, maximum wage, wealth tax, financial transactions tax. So bring the top of the pyramid down. But while we do that, we also have to make it easy for people to get by on less. People in a shrinking economy, a lot of people are going to have less. And we have to make sure the folks at the bottom of that economic pyramid have enough. So number five, somewhat related, reverse financialization. It's been a big trend, especially over the past 30 years, more and more debt, more and more innovative ways of creating and recycling debt. All of that has to go away. So regulations and taxes, I already mentioned financial transactions tax, pretty obvious ways of dealing with that. Why not just ban derivatives as a way to start the whole process? Number six, population. We can't not talk about this. There are too many of us, and the population is still growing. If the economy is contracting, we're going to be able to handle this much better if there are fewer of us all the time. So promoting the idea of small families, the virtue of non-reproduction, I'm not talking about coercive population reduction, but providing incentives and cultural incentives, not necessarily financial incentives, but cultural incentives to reducing the population size until we get it back within a scale that nature can support long term. Number seven, decommodification of labor, land, and money. I hope you were here yesterday to hear Andy Kimbrell's masterful talk about the roots of capitalism. The commodification of labor, land, and money is what's gotten us to where we are now. So we've got to reverse that process. Rather than promoting the idea of everybody being employed by somebody else, jobs, 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 how about professions, professions, professions? Promote the not just the idea of the commons, but the reality of the commons everywhere, reducing the role of money in society so that fewer and fewer human interactions are monetized. We're already seeing a trend toward that with the sharing economy, but let's go further to the gift economy. Deprivatization of cultural commons, as Chet Bowers was saying so eloquently this morning. Number eight, relocalization. You know, with less oil, we're going to have less transportation. It's inevitable. So let's plan for it. We will have less trade. That doesn't mean trade is going away altogether. People have been trading with each other since we were hunters and gatherers. But the scale of trade has gone completely out of balance with what is sustainable over the long term. So less transportation, less trade, more local production, especially in necessities. And again, this is a trend that we're already seeing, the valorization of local food, local money, and so on. But of course, this trend needs to become the dominant trend rather than the fringe trend. Number nine, re-ruralization. You know, urbanization has been a huge demographic trend over the last century, made possible largely because of the cheap energy of fossil fuels. Without fossil fuels, without cheap energy, without economic growth, urbanization is going to reverse itself. Again, let's get ahead of the trend and revitalize towns and villages throughout the world and help young farmers gain access to land. Okay, so we're coming to the end here. Number 10 in the 10-point plan is let's use happiness metrics and not GDP. Promote cultural goods, that things that make us happy but don't cost money, or don't have to cost money, music, dance, art, seasonal festivals. Let's have a good time as the economy contracts, because it's not economic growth that makes us happy. So why should we even pay attention to that? At the end of the day, is all of this a description of a better or a worse world? Well, I don't know, let's find out. Right now, I think it's my idea of a good time.